The media landscape in America is busted. Americans are on to the omissions, the half-truths, and the outright lies being propagated against we, the people. Your host, Tom Harris, will bring you the other side of the story.
Today's program is a cautionary tale for Republicans considering supporting the climate scare in an effort to win back the White House and the Senate. You see, conservative leaders in Canada are promoting climate alarmism by using the language of their opponents, carbon pollution, carbon emissions, low carbon energy, etc., and they're promoting solutions to problems that many of them know does not exist. This has been going on for years, divorcing the party brass from the wishes of many grassroots conservatives who want their leaders to tell the truth about climate change. And the truth is, of course, that the climate scare is not founded on reliable science, and it threatens to destroy Canada's and America's economy and energy security. But party strategists believe that they know best and that they will have to support the climate scare to attain power. As we'll discuss in today's episode, they're completely wrong. A sensible step-by-step strategy to kill the climate scare in Canada and the U.S. would not only help our countries immensely, but would show conservatives to be real leaders both our nations desperately need. To discuss this with me and my co-host, Todd Royal, who's online with me, we are joined by Joseph Benamy. Joseph is a former policy aide to both Stephen Harper, Canada's former conservative prime minister, as well as Stockwell Day, Harper's predecessor as party leader. Well, Joseph is a former naval officer. He is host of the Joseph Benamy Show, offering insights on culture, politics, and current affairs from a conservative perspective. Joseph was president of the Arthur Meehan Institute for Public Affairs, executive director of the Institute for Canadian Values, and director of government relations and diplomatic affairs for the Jewish advocacy group B'nai B'rith. He's served on numerous organizational boards, and including, which will be very interesting, I think, to our listeners, the Advisory Board of Jews Against Anti-Christian Defamation. So, Joseph, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you, Tom, as always.
Yeah, Joseph, thank you so much. I'm real excited to have you here, and I really want to jump in and just begin to fire away questions at you and just hear your thoughts. What do you really believe is this primary driver, this public opinion about climate change?
Well, there are a lot of factors, obviously, that go into driving that particular narrative. But the most important issue is whether or not there is any kind of sustained and credible opposition to it. And the main driver of opposition, and there's a lot of research to back this up, the main driver of opposition are our political leaders, the people that we elect in our democracies. You know, we like to call our democracies liberal democracies. And I usually try to avoid that term because it's become, you know, a little bit too partisan for me one way or the other. But what we definitely are, we're definitely representative democracies. We don't have direct democracy where we too much. I know in the United States that you have some initiatives where voters put questions to on a ballot, but but by and large, our governments are representative democracies, and as such, we look to the people that we elect to represent us in order to lead, and that's really what we're looking for, and that's really what's missing in this whole thing on climate change and government policies, particularly here in Canada. In the United States, you have political leaders who are not afraid to stand up and say, this is not based on sound science, and we don't agree that there's a climate emergency. But we don't have anything like that here in Canada. And by the way, I should say also, Todd, that the research that's been done on this indicates that while celebrities, that is to say Hollywood celebrities, influencers on the internet, and even news media personalities, while these individuals play a role in promoting the climate scare, the real factor is the position that our political leaders are taking. And I know it sounds a little odd because the truth is we all know that in this day and age, political leaders are not necessarily, you know, looked at with great respect and, etc. by the population. But it's true. Our political leaders are really the drivers one way or the other of this file.
I'll just put up under the podcast when it goes up on Monday, a link to a paper which was done by researchers at McGill University, Drexel University, and Ohio State, where they were looking at what were the main drivers of climate opinion in the public, climate change opinion, what were the main drivers in the U.S.? And what they concluded was just like you said, Joseph, it was the politicians, not the science, not the media, although they have influence. It was the statements of the politicians. Do you think they're realistic in that?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. And as I said, Tom, there's plenty of research to back this up. It's not just on this file. It's on various files. You know, people turn the news on. They read the newspapers. You know, they don't absorb the material the way perhaps we used to in our society. It's a sort of a cursory glance, perfunctory thinking about et cetera. But our political leaders come to us and they want our vote. They convince us one way or the other about what policies should be. We pay more attention to what they're saying. We listen to them. We argue with them. We argue about them. You know, nobody's sitting around the kitchen table coming up with you guys have it down in the States a presidential election this November. You know, in Columbus Day, nobody's going to be sitting around the dining room table with a family arguing about what CNN had to say about climate change or what Fox News, to be fair, and look at the other side of the equation, or Newsmax, or any of those. No, they're arguing about what the politicians are saying, what they're going to do, what they're not going to do, why they're going to do it, why they're not going to do it. That's where the focus is. And so that's where the focus of the debate has to be if you want to push back effectively.
And, you know, it's interesting because I've heard from so many conservatives and they're going to say the same thing to me at the Strong and Free Networking Conference coming up here in Canada, which is a conservative conference. They're going to say, no, we want to get elected. We can't say that until public opinion supports that. But if that's the approach they take, they could wait for a very long time if they are the major driver of public opinion.
Well, as you know, Tom, I've said this before, They take a stand and they base their stand on public opinion without really understanding that the stand that they're taking is the main driver of the public opinion that they claim to be reacting to or not reacting to. So I call this kind of like a communication feedback loop, and they're completely oblivious to it. But, you know, it isn't just the communication side, and it's not just about whether we're convincing people about climate change or not. There are some very real practical implications to taking the kinds of stands that, say, the Conservative Party here in Canada is taking. Rather than saying the science is not sound and there is no climate emergency, which is the position they should be taking, what they do is they basically say, well, we agree that there's a climate emergency. They may not say it explicitly, but if you're going to substitute carbon pricing, so-called, our carbon tax here in Canada, with a carbon sequestration, let's say, which is the kind of thing that the Conservatives are talking about. Well, here's the problem with that. The first thing is everybody tends to agree then that there's a climate emergency and we must do something about carbon dioxide. So what happens when you actually get into power? Now you're trapped. You have to follow through with a policy that you know is not going to be effective. And then once you follow through with that policy and it isn't effective, you have to wear, because you know the Liberals are going to be saying this, they're going to go, you see, we told you it wouldn't work. Our policy of carbon pricing was working.
Huh.
Or you can abandon the policy altogether because you don't believe it in the first place, in which case you're leaving yourself open to the Liberals coming back and saying, you lied to us. You lied to the Canadian people. And of course, what are Conservatives going to come back and say? Well, you're right. We lied. We didn't really believe in climate change. So there is perhaps a short-term gain electorally in taking the kind of position that the Conservatives are taking. But the long-term damage to the brand and to the country is just as severe. And here's the final thought on terms of policy after the election. I for the life of me, I can't understand why nobody in the Conservative Party understands that if you're going to do carbon sequestration, whatever that ends up being, that that's going to add cost to consumers as well. Either the government is going to pay for whatever that program looks like, in which case Canadians are going to pay for it through taxes, or the government's not going to, and they're going to force through regulation private industry to take the initiative and pay for it, in which case consumers are going to pay for it in higher prices. So that this all raises the very uncomfortable question: ultimately, what's the difference to consumers or taxpayers, however you look at them, of one policy over the other policy?
One of the economists compared the previous conservative leader's plan, his regulations, with the carbon tax and said that the conservative approach was more expensive. So what the heck are they doing?
Joseph, I've got a
Go ahead.
question for you. You brought up two really interesting points. The questions are different, but I still want to pose them to you. Number one, which politicians do you, I'm here in the United States, so which politicians do you see in the United States that are effectively speaking out against the science not being sound? Please do that one. And then I want to ask you something about, carbon capture and sequestration, because I wonder, do you know about it? Because I've always had this feeling that when you begin to pump copious amounts of CO2 gas down into the ground, is it going to have the same effect that fracking fluid has had when you begin to pump an inordinate amount, and that we know that that's caused, minor earthquakes? So what you're talking about is fascinating, and I want to ask you these two questions, if that's okay.
Right. Well, you're going to be disappointed because I couldn't tell you for sure. I couldn't name the names of the people who are political leaders in the United States who are
Sure.
taking a stand on this. I want to say people like Ted Cruz, and I know who was the former governor. You're in Texas, I believe. So who was your former governor?
Yes. Former governor is Rick Perry.
Rick Perry, I believe, was also on this file, and a number of other people. It's not a rare thing for people to be skeptical about the so-called science behind the climate emergency. With respect to sequestration, well, you raise a good point, and I'm not against fracking. I hadn't actually considered that particular angle. And if I was advising the Liberal Party up here, I might actually say to them that they should consider bringing that up as a possible attack point against the conservative plans for sequestration. I just think the whole thing is bunk. I think the idea that you're going to somehow, whether you're going to isolate carbon dioxide in some manufacturing process, then pump it into some mine shaft somewhere and seal it, to me, it's science fiction. Okay. I hate people are going to listen to this podcast and they're going to go, that Ben-Ami again, he's just causing us all kinds of grief. I will say this, okay. I am dead set 100% irreconcilably against the carbon tax that we have here in Canada. I think carbon taxes are dumb. I think they're even dumber when you go, because the whole idea of a carbon tax, of course, is to discourage people from using carbon fuel, fossil fuel. Well, people then complain about the carbon tax, so our government turns around and says, well, don't worry, we're going to give you a rebate. Well, what's the point of charging more for the fuel if you turn around and you reimburse people for the cost of paying the extra tax? And interestingly enough, the people who qualify for the rebate are low-income people who are exactly the kind of people who are going to have difficulty affording to pay the tax, and as consequent, are going to reduce their consumption of fossil fuel. Middle class people who maybe they don't qualify, so there may be some saving there, but people who are in the upper end of the income bracket, they don't care. It's just one more thing. I've got to pay a little bit more tax. But I'm not getting rid of my SUV.
Yeah, and
So,
they're the biggest emitters of carbon dioxide.
the whole thing is just nonsense. But And this is what's going to get me into trouble, guys. But if I wanted to take, so formulate some sort of a policy to discourage people from using fossil fuels, I would go with the target carbon tax. I would not be going with some science fiction idea about carbon sequestration. I just wouldn't do it. So now some people are going to take this and they're going to cut it up into these little sound bites, and they're going to go, there's Ben and me supporting the liberal carbon tax. I am not. Let me make that perfectly clear. I'm just saying that it makes more sense than the sequestration idea.
So, in other words, among the universe of stupid ideas, this is less stupid than sequestration. That doesn't sound like a very good plan.
Well, and the beauty of it is that you could just terminate it immediately, right? And you're not stuck with all of this infrastructure that you've paid for that you're never going to use. And it's funny, isn't it funny that the very people that are worried about carbon dioxide posing an existential threat to life on Earth, and so they talk about sequestration, but these are the same people that tell you that you can't, no matter how hard you try, you can't get rid of radioactive waste through what is essentially
Oh,
the same process, right?
yeah, and yet radioactive waste is a solid, and CO2 is a gas when it's not under pressure.
So
Chances of escaping are much greater.
exactly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, Joseph, there have been some natural CO2 bubbles that have suddenly blown out of lakes, like in the Cameroons, for example. I don't know if you folks are aware of this, but in Lake Nagos, there was a natural eruption of CO2 from the bed of the lake, and it came up, and it's invisible, of course. And it's amazing to see the stories that, and I'll put a link to it on Wikipedia. This is one of the things they actually describe well. This guy was on a motorcycle, and suddenly he noticed that people and animals were falling dead all around him, and he could see nothing. And he panicked and he zoomed off on his motorcycle. By good fortune, he drove in the right direction and he got out of the bubble. So, I don't think personally I'd want to live beside a CO2 sequestration site, would you?
Probably not. But I don't think it's going to come to pass. I don't think anyone's going to do it. See, that's the problem, is that the conservatives are, it's pure science fiction.
I think I should emphasize, I'm not saying they were falling dead because CO2 is a pollutant. It's because it's heavier than air and it displaces the air, so you don't have oxygen in the vicinity of where the CO2 bubble is. So that's the reason that it's potentially hazardous.
Yeah, I think what I've always wondered this, and the reason I asked you this question, Joseph, and I sure appreciate what you just said also, Tom, is that I did my master's thesis on fracking and got to understand it really well. And so fracking is perfectly fine, and it's how the United States does the majority of their exploration and production. I think it's 95% now, but you don't just shoot fracking fluid back down into the earth. It will cause earthquakes. Like, that will happen. And
Okay.
so I have wondered, why in the world does somebody want to shoot voluminous volume amounts of gas, CO2 gas, down into the earth? Does no one think that it's just going to sit there, like it's not going to do anything? That's why I wanted your thoughts and opinion on that, because I haven't heard anybody talk about that issue at all.
I think it's a great issue, and as I said, Todd, if I was advising the Liberal Party up here, I would tell them they should be all over this. They should be all over this because it makes sense.
Well, and in fact, Joseph, Elizabeth May from the Green Party has said that sequestration is insane for CO2. She says, "What, do you think we're going to stuff it under our pillow and it's never going to come out again?" So it's one of the few areas that I agree with the Green Party that it's a dumb answer.
Yeah, it's going down this path. I really love what you're saying, about leaders and conservative leaders. We've touched on this a little bit, but I just want to specifically ask you this language of climate alarmism. I think I know you think it's a mistake, but what is a better way for them to present their policies? I would assume you think it's a mistake for them to use the language of climate alarmism. So, do you think it's a mistake? And if you do, what is a better way for them, whether it's Canada or the United States, a better way for them to present their policies?
Yeah, I actually have a, I think, a good answer to this, and we
Okay.
did this during one of the campaigns for the what we have is we have leadership campaigns for the party up here, and I actually managed the campaign of one of the candidates too before. I guess we've had a bit of a revolving door process up here, and we struggled with this, of course, and the way we came up with it was we basically said, look. People are concerned about being good stewards of our environment. So this is our policy: clean land, clean air, clean water. Period. Full stop. And if you're worried about climate change, well, then what we need to do is we need to focus on adaptation and strengthening our energy grid. You know, I don't. We have here just actually last week we had a heavy snow storm roll through southern Ontario, eastern Ontario, and into the Maritime provinces, the Atlantic provinces, and it's a never-ending story of you get a little bit of wind and you get a little bit of snow, and all of a sudden you have tens of thousands of customers without electricity. Now, why is that? Well, that's because we don't bury our electrical cables. So every time there's a windstorm, and a tree falls, you have thousands of customers without power, and of course the hydro companies get overloaded with repairs. And so in some cases we have seen instances, Todd, here, hard to believe, in a first world country as rich as Canada is, we have instances where in urban areas you can go weeks without electricity. Weeks without electricity, because
Wow.
it takes that long for the grid to be repaired. And so it makes sense to prepare for extreme weather events if you believe that those are being caused by climate change. It makes sense just on its own merit to be prepared. So that was our stand. Our stand was, we're not going to stop the climate from changing. The climate has changed forever, one way or the other. If climate change wasn't real, Tom and I would be sitting under 2 kilometers approximately of ice right now, where we're situated. Okay, climate change is real. Okay, the question is not whether it's real or not. The question is whether or not, first of all, it's man-made, and the science, I think, is not sound on that. But whether the science is sound or not, we're not going to stop it. So, especially here in Canada, where we produce so little of the world's greenhouse gases, so-called. Okay, so you know, we could emit no carbon dioxide in Canada, and it's not going to make a difference to the global output in greenhouse gases, so-called. So our policy was clean air, clean land, clean water. Those are the talking points. And on climate change, well, you know, we're going to invest money in adapting to prevent the kind of lack of power and energy to homes during extreme weather events, whether they're caused by climate change or not.
Now, is there any reason why the current Conservative Party can't adopt exactly what you just said? It sounds so sensible.
Well, you're asking the wrong person. I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Because it's so obvious. That should be their policy.
Here's the thing is, so everybody's always afraid of what the media is going to say, though. Or the media is going to, they're going to crucify us. And my answer to that is, so let them. You know, people, I don't know why conservatives are so afraid of negative press. You know, the fact is that there's an old saying that no press is worse than bad press, okay? Or bad press is worse, better than no press. And that's absolutely true. You know, just because CNN or here in Canada, CBC or CTV, okay, just because they say something bad about your policies doesn't mean that people out there who hear your policies, even though they're being criticized, aren't going to go, well, that makes sense to me. And especially when you look at the polling and you see how much respect the general public has for the mainstream media. If it was me, I'd be saying, go 100% full on, and state your case, and people out there, they will hear what you have to say, and they'll make their own judgments. And I have a lot more faith in the average voter, I think, than most people have.
Wow. You leave me a little speechless. Would you expand on the issue you just talked about, where you said it doesn't matter how many greenhouse gases, GHG, carbon, CO2 is cut, whether it's even Canada or the United States? Would you expand on that? I've written about this before, so I think I know where you're going to be going with this, but I really would love you to expand on that. meaning the developing world is developing, and it doesn't matter what we cut.
Yeah, before we go on, we have to take a break now. So that's a great
Oh,
place.
shucks.
Yeah, right. I know it's a great place to start part two. So tune in for part two. It'll be back right after the break. Before we go to the break, I'd like to tell everybody about a new ready-to-eat metabolic health bar that I've started to make a regular part of my diet. It's called Heal Right, and it isn't just any old health food bar. It was developed after over 15 years of research by National Medal of Science recipient Dr. Bruce Ames and a team of scientists at University of California, San Francisco, Benioff Children's Hospital and Research Center at Oakland. Dr. Ames and his team developed Heal Right to address the epidemic of obesity and related diseases through micronutrition. They realized that the problems that many of us face with our health are not just due to consuming the wrong things, such as too much trans fats and sugar, but it's also due to the lack of sufficient micronutrients in our diet. In other words, the vitamins and minerals we need to be healthy. And that's the beauty of Heal Right food bars. Rather than having to consume countless vitamin and mineral pills and guessing at the correct dosages, these good-tasting bars give us over 20 essential micronutrients, antioxidants, fiber, proteins, and many other building blocks that promote high levels of health. To order Heal Right metabolic health bars, go to americaoutloud.shop and scroll down until you see the ad for Heal Right. Then click on the Heal Right ad and select Learn more to choose your order. I like caramel apple fig best. It's really wonderful. When you place your order, be sure to use the code OUTLOUD to receive 20% off, an exclusive benefit for the America Out Loud family of listeners and readers.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with Heal Right. Heal Right is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
The buildup of spike proteins is dangerous to your health. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body, removing the spike proteins, allowing your body to repair from within. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to americaoutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to americaoutloud.shop. That's americaoutloud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
When God, through His grace and mercy, gave us free will, the will of the people was to live freely. To that end, we fight for the liberty of all at a time when global tyranny threatens us as never before in mankind's history. This vision is manifest at AmericaOutloud.news, a site for all who cherish free will and freedom. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Joseph, we're back, and I really want to ask you, you know, again, you mentioned something a moment ago about Canada, and it doesn't matter what we cut, you know, so-called GHGs, carbon, CO2. Would you expand upon that? I've written some about this, and it even can include the United States. It doesn't matter how much we cut because of the developing world. What are your thoughts on this?
Sure. Well, look, there are two ways to look at it, Todd. The first is climate change being driven by human activity? And if it is, the reality is that if we in the West, and I'm speaking particularly about Canada because we have a small population, and given the immense size of the country and the temperature of our country, I'm constantly surprised that our carbon footprint, so-called, isn't much larger than it actually is. You guys have in the United States a fairly large carbon footprint. I use that term. I hate using it, but people will know what I'm talking about. But if you had a zero carbon footprint, you're not going to stop countries in Africa, countries in Asia. You're not going to stop developing economies from developing because you in the United States have decided, or in Europe, burning fossil fuels is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. They're not going to do it. By the way, there's a great clip, if you have a chance to pull it out at some point in time, of a recent interview between the president of Guyana and a BBC reporter.
Yes, I saw that.
Great, great pushback. And you know, I really, Tommy, if you might want to put it up somewhere.
I will. Yeah, I'll put it right after the podcast.
It's fantastic.
It's an example of a developing a president of a country that has one of the fastest growing economies in the world, but they're trying to pull themselves out of poverty. They're trying to become not even first world, just second world, if I could use that term, okay, economically. And we're going to tell them, here we are perched at the top of Mount Olympus, okay, in terms of economy, in terms of riches, in terms of comfort or standard of living, quality of life. Now we're going to lecture the rest of the world tell them, no, it's not going to, you guys can't do that. Mm-hmm. Well, they are just going to do what the president of Guyana did. And he basically very politely thumbed his nose and said, you know, go jump in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Lecture me. I'm going to lecture you. And that's the lecture, really. You know, how dare you now? Okay. Don't talk to us. You have other solutions for energy? I guess we're all ears. But so far, the only thing that we're proposing is that they follow us now that we even have a wonderful economy and a wonderful life. Follow us now in this chaotic sort of quest for a carbon-free economy or whatever. The rest of the world is not going to follow us, okay? Get with the program, people. Okay. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, whether we contribute to climate change or not, it's only a contribution. Climate change is a very natural thing. And we could have, human beings could have hypothetically no effect on the climate, and we're still going to have climate change. Okay. You know, what is wrong with our education system? This is a totally separate topic, but what is wrong with our education system where people are graduating from high school and they don't know the first thing about just the basic geological history of the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I would think that when a politician says we have to stop climate change, that the appropriate audience reaction is laughter. They should just laugh at him. What an imbecile.
The other thing is, why, okay, you know, maybe in the year 2024, okay, we've got to stop climate change. And I go, okay, well, I don't know. You're trying to make a case that we're in some sort of a dangerous situation. Existential is the problem. Okay. But, you know, good thing you weren't around 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. We have to stop climate change. No, we need to accelerate climate change. Thank you very much.
That's right.
There's a certain hubris, if I might say so, to all of this whole debate. It stems from this false notion that human beings are the center of the universe, that everything that goes perfectly right in the universe and everything that goes wrong in the universe is somehow or other due to us, our good things or our bad things, our good actions or bad actions. You know what? The universe doesn't give a damn about us. Okay? One way or the other.
So, well, yeah, like the eclipse yesterday. That was gorgeous, but at the same time, it was not something we... In fact, stopping climate change is kind of like trying to stop eclipses, wouldn't you say?
Well, and you know, it's funny because I was actually doing some grocery shopping at the time of the eclipse, and as I walked into the store, people were offering me their glasses to watch the eclipse, and as I walked out, they were doing the same thing. And my response in both cases was, no, it's thanks very much, but it's not my first eclipse.
Good for you.
Joseph and Tom, I had the same feeling yesterday. Joseph, I've said that before. You just go, you look at the eclipse, and whether you believe in God or not, you can look around and go, and I'm someone who does believe in God and the Bible, but you do look around and go, I think this universe thing is a whole lot bigger than we are. And all of our little minuscule efforts is like the universe saying, we don't give a damn what you do. So, Joseph, I love that you've made this show for me. So thank you very much.
I had a conversation with somebody yesterday, a friend yesterday. And we were talking about, you know, how closely God pays attention to the world, et cetera, and how we have to figure all these things out. And I said to him, well, you know, the story of Job confronts God at some point in time and basically says, you know, why am I suffering? You know, explain it to me. And God answers him. And the answer is actually, I think, very profound. And not, mm-hmm. It's apropos to the discussion we're having now around climate change. The answer that God gives him is, yeah, okay, yeah, you're right. I'm responsible. And as for me explaining it to you, where were you when it created the universe?
Yeah.
In other words, there are things, and I understand if it makes us as human beings feel uncomfortable, but there are things that are beyond our control. And beyond even our understanding or our simple understanding. And we pursue truth as much as we can. We pursue scientific discovery, etc. Okay. But you still have to understand that at the end of the day, there are things, as much as we may even comprehend them, the minutiae of these issues, we may not be able to control them. And climate change is one of those things. Whether you believe in the creation of the universe or of Earth, or you believe that just happened by accident, one way or the other, climate change has been around since day one. It's going to be around long after human beings have stopped walking this planet.
Yep.
Yet we can make ourselves more resilient to it. And so, of course, that's the thing to do. You know, it's funny, here in Ottawa, they did an analysis to see what it would cost to bury existing cables underground that, you know, currently are above ground. And it varied from $2 to $5 million per kilometer. And they said, oh my God, we can't afford that. And then they turn around and they want a $57 billion plan, a billion with a B, which would bury thousands of kilometers of cables, more than there are in the whole city. So it sounds to me like we're just simply focused on the wrong stuff.
and you can't, the thing is, you don't have to, for a program to bury electrical cables, if that's what we're talking about now, you don't have to have this something that you just start going across the city burying cables. There's road rehabilitation that goes on all the time. There is no reason why we aren't, when we repave a road or we expand a road, widen a road, there's no reason why we aren't at the same time solidifying the infrastructure around it, the electrical grid. And I know it presents some engineering problems. I get that. But surely to goodness, we have a better capacity, ability to solve overcome those engineering challenges than, you know, trying to stop climate change. And by the way, you brought up, Tom, you just brought up this the city of Ottawa, and a good illustration of what happens when you get locked into a position, as we were saying that would happen with the Conservatives, is the city of Ottawa here that has been got itself locked into a position that it's going to convert our municipal bus fleet from gas, from fossil fuel to electricity. So you know, a number of us were warning them, saying, you know, well, we don't have the capacity to provide electrical power to these buses, et cetera, all of the negatives. But no, they dismissed all of the naysayers. Okay, you're just you're knuckle dragging, anti-science, flat Earth Neanderthals. Okay, so they've just started replacing our fossil fuel fleet. They're doing a pilot project now with a handful of electrical buses. But guess what? It turns out that they don't have the capacity to charge them. So they're going around driving these electrical buses, taking the victory lap, as far as the bus will go, that is. But this is the best part, Todd. The best part is, how do you think those buses are being powered? They're being powered by natural gas fired electrical generators in the bus yard this is exactly what happened. Is they got, rather than saying we made a mistake, they get so deeply invested in something now it's not working, but they're not saying it's not working. They're just going ahead and purchasing these, I think it was four megawatt natural gas fired electrical generators to power our bus. And it isn't even the full fleet yet. Conservatives they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Us who are still wearing pants, but that's a separate story altogether. they're going to get themselves locked into a policy framework that they don't want to do, but they're going to end up having to do it anyway.
Let me ask you this then, Joseph. It's really going back what you just said. You just talked about the electrical grid, because really what you're talking about is the electrical grid. It just doesn't have enough energy going into it. So then why, we've asked you this question about politicians, conservatives, why won't they just speak about this as plainly as you just did? That's a great example. If I were on a campaign trail, I'd go, hey, we've got these buses. We said we're going to use electricity. Hey, maybe they would work. They don't work. Here's why. My policy is we're going back to fossil fuel. The buses are cleaner to begin with, as opposed to these electrical ones that aren't that clean as you think, the battery, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't these guys just plainly talk about it the way you just spoke about it?
Yeah, it just comes down to, I think that they're just afraid. They're convinced that they will not get the votes if they are perceived to be climate change deniers, to boil it down. When I talk to my friends in the party, I tell them that's wrong. It's wrong. First of all, your assessment is wrong. And second of all, even if your assessment is right, believe me, you know, I'm 62 years old, Todd. I've been in this business for a long time. I understand sometimes you have to fight an election out on principle and risk losing, because in the long run, people are going to listen to you. But if you're constantly chasing after that short-term electoral gain, in the long run, it's disastrous for the party. And I think that if you look at the history of the Conservative Party in Canada, I think that bears out fairly strongly. I just think it comes down to they've convinced themselves that if they take a stand as plainly as we're talking about it now on this show, that they're going to get, it's going to go badly for them with voters, and they don't want to take that risk. So they're willing to take a position that they don't believe in, for the most part, I think it's important also to point out that there probably are a number of policy advisors that actually do buy into the climate scare around. But that's it. That's the best answer I can give you.
So do you think the grassroots at this coming convention, for example, should go to the microphone and say to their leaders, hey, what are you doing? You know, I mean, this is terrible for Canada. It's bad for the party. What are you doing? So should they push back?
Well, of course they should push back. But, you know, here's the thing that this is another thing that has not necessarily apropos to the discussion we're having now on climate change and the conservative position, et cetera. But, you know, at some point in time, and this has been very effective in terms of the establishment within the Conservative Party silencing or censoring their own supporters, is to say, look, if you give us a black eye, okay, you know, people are just going to vote for the Liberals. Okay, so what do you want to do? You have to let us do what we're doing and let us get elected. And I suspect you probably get that in the States as well, it's always the shush, don't talk about this now, because if you talk about this now, then our political opponents are going to get elected. Of course, the argument, the extension of that argument is, if you're going to lose the election, if I talk about this now, or if we talk about this now, then you're going to not be able to get reelected if you talk about it after the election.
Yeah.
Okay. So the logic of we're only going to talk about this after the election doesn't make sense. And it never pans out. They never, never talk about the things after the election that they didn't want to talk about before the election.
Yeah, because Joseph, you know, when the Conservatives were in opposition under Harper, I was pushing them to start saying the kinds of things you're saying. And they said, no, we have to get elected first. And so once they got elected, I said, okay, now go ahead, say these things. They said, no, we have to have a majority government first. Okay, so then they got a majority government. And then I said, okay, go. No answer. And then years later, oh, we can't say that now. There's an election. And of course, they lost the election. But regardless, they always have an excuse. And it sounds to me like maybe some of these backroom people are well-meaning, but misinformed, like you say. But I also wonder, are some of these backroom people not really conservatives? Are they in fact red Tories? Is that a possibility?
I'm sure it is. I know it is. I know that, you know, there are people, there's a diversity of opinion within the Conservative Party. And you're going to have some strong influence from, you know, people who are not really conservative. I'm a very strong, as you know, Tom, I'm a very strong social conservative. I like to poke my friends in the Conservative Party in the side and point out to them that, you know, when they say, well, I'm a fiscal conservative, but I'm a social liberal. And I go, you know, that's just an oxymoronic statement. Emphasis on the moronic part of oxymoronic. You cannot be a social liberal and a fiscal conservative, because social policy drives fiscal policy. So it's nonsense, and it's the same right across the board. They focus on I'm a fiscal conservative. What does that even mean? Does that mean that you have to be responsible with your money? Guess what? You know, I guess, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union was already 30 some years ago, right? So there's a whole lot of voters out there that weren't even born yet. But even the leaders of the Soviet Union realized at some point in time that they had to pay the bills. There's nothing inherently conservative in being fiscally responsible. Okay. Every other policy is what makes you a conservative or not a conservative. And then it comes down to, well, how do we pay for what we're doing? Okay. And the conservative position is whatever the choices are, you pay for them responsibly. So that might be a little more expensive. It might be a little less expensive, but simply having a low budget isn't necessarily inherently conservative. It all depends on what you want. And if you want liberal policy, then you're gonna, you know, then you should be paying for liberal policy. Of course, we don't do that. Well, of course, you guys don't do that down in the States either. You're constantly having to find we look at you guys and we go, oh my goodness gracious, is there that much money in the world?
No, there's not. And as someone who's done economic work and studied economics, I think we're in for a very rude awakening. And I think so much of it all gets wrapped together with climate scare, climate alarmism, abortion, whether you believe in, you know, gay marriage or not, all those things, you know, do you believe in green policies? Do you not? I think it all gets wrapped up together. And I appreciate you saying that you can't divorce the two and say, oh, I'm fiscally conservative, but socially liberal, when birth rates are, it's causation for economic development. That's been proven. That's without a doubt. We can run those regressions all day long, or for people who don't understand regressions, we can just do the math. It's very, very easy to understand those policies. So I appreciate you saying that.
And the birth rate is a very big problem in Western countries. And
yes,
here in Canada in 2022, we set a record for the lowest fertility rate on record. Interestingly enough, a month later, Statistics Canada reported that our population has grown in 2023 at a record rate, right? So it's all immigration. Again, whether you're pro-immigration, anti-immigration, let's set that aside for a minute. But, you know, the fact is that we're not reproducing ourselves, and that's going to have, I think, a potential dire effect on economic progress as well. But one final thing I have to say, you know, just sort of to pull back on the whole climate change thing and this whole idea of self-censoring, which is, you know, essentially what conservatives are doing and demanding that their supporters do largely. And I just can't help but make the observation that they're doing that at exactly the same time that they're fighting right now this free speech fight here in Canada, where we have legislation now that is probably the most draconian anti-free speech piece of legislation that I've ever seen coming out of a so-called free society. You know, it, what's happening in people are talking about what's happening in Scotland with their new legislation around hate speech, etc. This, what we're proposing here, what the government is proposing here, makes that look like child play. So here we are, we're fighting that battle, and we're talking about the importance of free speech to a healthy democracy, at the same time that the very people who are making that argument are basically saying, whatever you do, don't talk freely about this topic because, you know, it may have an electoral effect. And you would think that the defenders of free speech would be the last people to be censoring themselves because they're concerned about electoral prospects as a consequence of speaking freely. Mm. Without understanding that free speech is the way we change people's minds. We will never change people's minds if we don't exercise our right to free speech.
Mm, yeah, well put indeed. So we only have a minute to go. So just to wrap up, do you think that the Conservatives Party of Canada should be developing a strategy to ultimately try to kill the climate scare in Canada?
I do, but I would say, given the fact that we're 17 months away, 16 months away from a general election, you know, I just don't see them doing it. Mm-hmm. Not changing something and putting it in their platform. Mm-hmm. You know, I always think it's worthwhile to be lobbying our representatives to, you know, adopt a more sensible climate policy. But I don't think that you'll get them to talk about it pre-election or during the election campaign. Mm-hmm. And so I think really the best we can hope for is, you know, just the Liberal Party right now is so profoundly unpopular right now in this country, and as is Prime Minister Trudeau. And I don't see him stepping down before the election. So, you know, my advice would be just shut up about climate change and ride that anti-liberal wave. And at least that way you have a clean slate that you can work from after the election is held next year.
Yeah.
Rather than taking a stand that you then have to follow through on.
Right. So in other words, the policy that you were saying you were using previously with the candidate that you were supporting, in other words, clean air, land and water, and adapt and resilience to climate change. So when you talk about climate change, that's all you should say. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's it. Finished.
Period.
It's a great way to present it, and it's accurate. It encompasses everything you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, you're not pulling the wool over anyone's eyes. It's not propaganda. It's you're telling people what you believe in.
Yeah, and exactly.
Who doesn't believe in clean water?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, exactly. And I know we can go into that in this country as well, but you know, with our indigenous population, you know.
Anyway, we have to wrap up now, unfortunately. This has been really fun, Todd, and I'm going to certainly share this interview with a lot of people, especially in the Conservative Party, because the platform that you've been presenting and the approach, it makes so much sense. Who's going to argue against you? I mean, nobody is going to argue against you. So say nothing about the goofy greenhouse gas emission stuff and focus on sensible plan, just like you said. So it's really been fun having you on, Joseph. Thanks so much for being our guest today.
Yes, thank you, Joseph, very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Okay. Well, this is Tom Harris and Todd Royal with our guest, Joseph Benamy, signing out from the other side of the story. Before we end the program, I'd like to remind listeners to check out these Heal Right food bars. Okay, they contain over 20 essential micronutrients, antioxidants, fiber, protein, and many other building blocks that promote high levels of health. To order these Heal Right bars, go to americaoutloud.shop and scroll down until you see the ad for Heal Right. Then click on the Heal Right ad and select Learn More to choose your order. As I said earlier, I love caramel, apple, fig best. Well, anyway, when you place your order, be sure to use the code OUTLOUD to receive 20% off. That's an exclusive benefit for the America Out Loud family of listeners and readers.